do this, okay? So, my name is Michael Klein. I'm here with Carrie Klein in the trustees room of the Concord Free Public Library. It's June 3rd, and a rainy morning has fared off into a beautiful afternoon. And so would you please say my name is and introduce yourself?
My name is Stona Fitch.
And your date of birth?
July 7th, 1961.
61. And maybe you start off, just tell us about your people and where you were raised.
My family is originally from Arkansas and of Scottish heritage. They headed west early, intermarried with the Cherokees in that area. My father moved away from Arkansas and Oklahoma to Cincinnati, Ohio, where I was born. He moved to work for Procter & Gamble. The headquarters is based in Cincinnati. I've lived in Concord for almost 25 years now, and I consider it my home.
Came from Arkansas, did you say?
Right. My great-grandfather and previous generations before that lived in just outside of Little Rock and active in the Confederacy. And then I was, along with my sister, the first of our generation to sort of head east beyond Cincinnati. I'd never been east of Cincinnati until I moved here.
So what sort of people were they?
My family started out mostly as cattle ranchers. My grandfather was a cattle rancher as well and a politician. He was a state representative in Oklahoma out of Hughes County for several terms, attended Kennedy's inaugural, one of the highlights of his life. We share the same name, my father and my grandfather and my great-grandfather, Stona, which means in Creek or Cherokee supposedly means strong-hearted. So they were cattle ranchers. They worked really hard. They lived through the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma. And whenever we would complain about anything as a kid, my father would just say, "Don't tell me about it. I grew up in the Dust Bowl." You know, so that was a pretty easy way to make us feel like we had a lot more advantages than he did.
That became the standard for him.
It was a good line. I mean, because I'm a writer, I've always been fascinated by family heritage, just to draw upon, you know, where you're from, the sort of themes that cross over many generations. And I wouldn't say that a lot of my books are autobiographical, per se. My first one was. But I just think knowing, and I was told this when I was in college, my mentor in college was a writer named Russell Banks, and he instilled in me the need to know exactly where your character came from, and that means geographically, emotionally, financially, socioeconomically, just to really triangulate who is this person. And that's an approach I take when I write anything. You have to really know who you're writing about.
So can you talk about finding the voice at the tip of your pencil point?
I always wrote stories, and I veered towards journalism when I was a kid. I was the editor of my high school paper, and I freelanced for my local paper in Cincinnati, and I went on to become editor of the college paper at Princeton, the Daily Princetonian. So I always really enjoyed digging in to other people's stories and trying to tell them clearly. And I also worked as a reporter for the Miami Herald and a feature writer for the Anchorage Daily News after I was out of college. So my focus early on was really like getting the details down of someone else's story. But I also, you know, I love fiction. I love dark fiction. I love mysteries and crime books. And I knew I wanted to write my own books, too. And so evenings, weekends, and federal holidays during my day job, you know, I would start to work on a book. And my first novel I wrote while I was washing dishes at a barbecue. And I sent it out in a box, you know, like you did in the old days before there was email. And about 2 weeks later, I got a call from an editor at G.P. Putnam's that I'd sent the box to because I found his name in the back of somebody else's book in the thank yous. And I thought, well, this must be a nice guy. So I got a call on the payphone, and he said, this is, you know, Dan Harvey from G.P. Putnam's. We love this novel, Strategies for Success. And he said, you know, how about $50,000? And at that point, I was making $5 an hour and all the barbecue I could eat. And I thought for a long time. It was a long pause over the phone, and I finally said, listen, I just don't have that kind of money. And he said, no, we pay you. And I said, that sounds a lot better. In fact, a lot better. So my first novel, is called Strategies for Success, about a Southerner sort of lost in the East, which is very much more autobiographical than anything else I've written. And it did what books do. It came out and it disappeared. So my real work as a writer has been to continue to fight every book I've written into print, not having, you know, a huge success with my first book. I think it's been, you know, I would advise that that's a great experience for any writer because it really makes you figure out whether you're going to stick with it. If you have a huge success, it's pretty easy. You know you're going to, you have to. But having a book that comes out and sort of does okay but doesn't get doesn't become a bestseller really makes you focus on your work and recognize that you have to feel compelled to tell a story late at night when you have a day job and you're tired and you have young kids, you know. So for me, I love to write. And back to your original point, I've always loved to write. And as I've gotten older, I think I've gotten better at accessing imagination versus just facts.
So out of the dust of these cattle ranching people comes this compulsion to explore other people's stories and to write them. I'm wondering if there's a connection between that and the traditional lives of the people in your family.
Well, that's a really good point. I mean, my grandfather was one of the most talkative people I ever met. And, you know, he was both a cattleman and a politician and also an auctioneer. So he knew how to speak very quickly, something I have to watch in myself because I tend to blur. He could talk to anybody. He told stories. He could get along with anybody. And he loved to tell a good story and a joke. And he also had a filthy vocabulary, which was always helpful to hear when you're young. And I learned a lot from that. And he directed his expletives to cattle. You know, the cattle were always the recipients of the more blazing of the four-letter words. But he loved to tell stories, and he was, and I think also his father and other people I met from my family previous to that in Arkansas, they would just get together and sit in metal outdoor chairs, uncomfortable as all get out, and sit, no alcohol involved, and just sit there and talk. And you could hear them from miles away. They just open their mouths and never stopped. And my father, that was a very taciturn, quiet guy. I think that sort of it skips a generation, and maybe maybe he was just so sick of hearing people talk, he couldn't stand it. But I always went back to Oklahoma and to Arkansas in summers, and I think, yeah, part of that, inclination to tell a story out loud came from spending time around them. And they had some fascinating stories. They'd all been through a lot, and they were interesting people and really individuals. And they had these great, you know, sort of unusual American names like mine, you know, Stona. But in my grandfather's generation, there were, I think, 11 kids, and they were named Larkin, Sterling, Thad, Rolla, O'Neill, Roe, and Roa, set of twins. Rolla was Orville Faubus's right-hand man, so we don't talk about him much. And, just a full collection. And my aunt was named, Aunt Irma. And O'Neill was a woman. So they just tended to, they run out of biblical names, and they used them already. So they delved into, I think, whatever they could find. So, you know, these characters, you know, I would write my first novel, the main character's named Larkin, who was my grandfather's brother, who lived in Arizona, and he was involved in the asphalt trade. So I didn't know him at all. I just knew his name, and I used his name as my main character's name in my first novel. And I gave a copy to my grandmother, and she read it, and she didn't read a lot of novels. And she called me up, and she says, you know, I don't think your Uncle Larkin did any of this stuff. I go, no, Grandma, I used the name. I'm not writing a history of my Uncle Larkin. Although I'm sure it would be fascinating. But so I repurpose bits of family history, and there's certainly always more to use. But, you know, it comes from having that material to draw from. And I think every writer has, you know, sometimes you're given a lot of great material by your family, or sometimes you have to just make it all up. So I'm somewhere in the middle. I've got a lot of great family history that I try to pass on to my daughters a little bit here and there, not just the good stuff. And then I also feel an obligation to turn that into fiction, because I think the further you get away from the facts, then you can really find a richer vein of material, because it's like being limited by, you shouldn't be limited by just what you know. You have to write about what you don't know. And that's the, frequently when you're a writer, they say, write about what you know. Well, you know what? I think you should write about what you don't know, what's inside your brain, and where your imagination takes you, you know?
Say more about that. What do you mean by that?
Well, I wrote a novel called Senseless, which is arguably my hit, that came out in 2011 on 9/11. I'm sorry, 2001. Came out on 9/11, 2001, day of the Twin Towers. It's about a group of amoral terrorists who will do anything. So it came out of this really weirdly resonant time, and some of the phrasing from the main character, who's sort of a shadowy figure, it takes place in Belgium, tracked really closely to statements from bin Laden, to the point where when it came out in France, they printed, you know, verbatim statements from book to history. And I can't obviously claim that, oh, I'm just like picking up hidden frequencies that the world beams out. But I'd spent a lot of time in the sort of poorer neighborhoods of Brussels and Antwerp and felt a huge amount of anti-American sentiment. And I didn't know this. My experience was not, you know, as a person living in Belgium, you know, and sort of feeling like the EU, the creation of the EU, was a construct of the American government, which is the theme of my book. I didn't know this at all. It's certainly not part of my heritage. I didn't grow up in Europe. So it just, when I came back from that experience, and I was working there for several months, this story just sort of arrived about an American businessman who is held hostage in Belgium and sort of treated, you know, very poorly, but sort of having to revisit his own sins, you know, large and small, and having to really make a case for why he's innocent or not. And that has very little to do with me. This character was 60 years old. I was 40 when I wrote the book. His politics and his experience, he was a sort of a man of the senses. It was very different from mine. And even his points of view were different. So I felt like in just absorbing the information around some other place, very alien from my own and alien from Concord, that I was able to tell a story that was more of a work of the imagination. In fact, not even the imagination, but the subconscious. I came back from Belgium. One night I woke up and this entire novel showed up pretty much of a piece. And I'd obviously been thinking about it here and there. But I sat down in the guest room and wrote out page after page, and I would go back to sleep and I'd say, well, wait a minute, there's more. And then I would drop my kids at preschool and come here to the Concord Free Public Library and sit in the reference room and write what has been called the most disturbing novel ever written, after having dropped my girls off and put their stuff in the cubbies and whatever. And so there's such a split between my life experience and writing this book that it was really jarring and phenomenal. because my life was peaceful, wonderful daughters, beautiful little school, great town, incredible library. And I sat down and wrote, you know, a book that was completely the opposite of that, because that's where it forced me to use my imagination.
What forced you?
The story itself was so compelling to me, and it wasn't my own story. I think I was fascinated by trying to capture a character and an ambiance and a world that I didn't know anything about. It's like having secret entree into another world. And I think fiction is, from the reader's point of view, what I love about books is that they transport you to another place. From a writer's perspective, the great challenge is to create that place. And it may be a place you know very well, it may be a place you just completely make up. Every writer is somewhere along the continuum of, you know, is this something I know well and I've been there all my whole life, or is it something that I just sit down, you know, in the reference room and make up? So that's pretty much what I took to be my challenge with that book, was I didn't have a lot of accumulated information that I was drawing on. I had to really flick that little toggle switch on your brain that clicks you over into your imagination. And my first novel, I didn't do that. My first novel is usually very close to home, and it's usually about the author's family when you get down to it. I think there's probably some percentage someone has figured out, but most first novels are pretty close to home. This was my second, but I'd written several in between. But I think I took it as a personal challenge to do exactly the opposite of the first one. It's always good to choose. Each book is a new challenge. If I just wrote the same thing over and over, I would quickly bore myself and my readers.
But it was based on this experience you had in Antwerp. In Antwerp.
Yeah.
And really tasting in your gut, any sentiment?
Well, I think that writers are like the canaries in the coal mine, and they tend to pick up on things a little faster because, you know, you can smell the poison a little earlier. And it's if you're oriented towards that. And I love to write books that have larger ideas worked into what would be perceived as more conventional thriller plots. So things move quickly, and there's things that happen that are plot-driven, as they say. And in this case, it's about his ongoing ordeal as a hostage and ultimately his release. But throughout that time, you know what's going to happen to him, and it's all really unpleasant. So you're sort of forced to, it's a very short, compressed book, but can I make it through this book? I get email pretty much every week from someone who's like read half of it and then thrown it across the room, then gone, walked across the room, picked up the book, read another few pages, thrown it. You know, there's a lot of that because it's really a challenging book. But I just got an email like today from a reader in Russia who wants to, on her own dime, translate it into Russian because she knows that it has to come out there as well. So, you know, when you get notes like that, it's like, wow, that's a lot of work. I think the translating it, even a short book, into Russian would be hard. So things like that are very encouraging.
That's a lot of affirmation.
A lot of affirmation. It's also 12 years since it came out, so it's good to see. It's come out in 15 different languages and been made into a film, and it's on its way to becoming a French graphic novel, which, of course, is very important to some readers. So just the reason I say that is that I think that works of the pure imagination, nothing's that pure, sometimes they tend to be the more resonant ones because they're limitless. There's no boundary of fact. You know, you can go anywhere with it. And I love the feeling of being late at night working on something that I don't even know what it is. That's fun. If it's just sitting there late at night with a set of index cards with, well, chapter one, this is what happens, and chapter two, this is what happens. You know, then you might as well be, you know, that's more about the completion of the work versus the focus that it takes to sort of come up with something brand new, which is, you know, make it new, right? Who was that, Ezra Pound? Make it new.
So you studied writing at Princeton then, did you
say? I did. I went to Princeton on an academic scholarship that was sort of designed to help people who, it was sort of a push school for me. And I felt like a kid in a candy store. I mean, it was like I had gone to a pretty, a good but big public high school, and it was just an amazing leap for me, and a hard one. But and I was not, you know, I was a kid with white corduroys, and you know, and looking very much out of place among all these very much affluent East Coast guys that all had gone to prep school, you know, and this was back in the day, and I quickly realized that they didn't have anything on me, and I decided that I would focus on writing for the newspaper, because that was sort of the traditional enclave for people who like to write, and I found my home there. And but you know, my freshman and sophomore year, I was studying with Joyce Carol Oates and with Russell Banks and writers of that ilk. And I mean, what an opportunity! And Princeton's writing program at that point was—it's always been and still is—focused on undergraduates. So, you know, as a 19-year-old, you know, studying with a writer like that, I'm still in touch with both of them. We're cohorts, and they helped me found the Concord Free Press, which is our side project, a publishing house that is very different from other publishing houses. So, yeah, I ended up at the East Coast based on getting into Princeton. I really never left. I worked briefly elsewhere, but once I moved to Boston, I've been here ever since.
Wow. You mentioned the Concord Free Press. Can you develop that idea a little bit?
Yeah, you know, we talked a bit about books and how to get them out in the world. And my fourth novel is a book called Give and Take, which is about a jazz pianist traveling around the country, sort of a Robin Hood rewrite, in that he steals two items, two commodities, diamonds and BMWs, and sells them and gives the money away. So he's sort of a one-man economic force, you know, traveling through the country. And he's very funny. My main character is a protege of Miles Davis and people like that. He's much of an old-style jazz player traveling this very high-end circuit of mythical circuit of lounges and clubs. And so he has access to lots of diamonds and BMWs. And he makes short work of them. And his nephew shows up and basically challenges his, you know, sort of worldview about sharing the wealth, and it's and hilarity ensues. And so it was a book I loved because it was a little lighter. It didn't have much to do with me. I mean, I'd been a traveling musician, but not a jazz musician. But it got at some ideas about generosity that I was interested in. It was about to be published in New York. My editor left, and the book was orphaned in a way that books are often orphaned in publishing. And I really had a couple choices, either to put it aside and not worry about it, or try to find another publisher, which at that point was very difficult, and that we had tried a lot of publishers already. And this is a major house, so I wanted it to come out and is edited and ready to go. So I had, in Concord, worked as a board member and then board director, a group called Gaining Ground, which is a farm out at Thoreau's birthplace, east of here. And it's at that point, you know, an eight-acre plot of land owned by the town of Concord that we farm and grow produce and give it all away to homeless shelters and meal programs. So it's a very Concord group in that it's run by volunteers primarily. The volunteers do all the work. We've got a couple staff people, but it's a very sustainable, very low impact and very high return group. All the third graders here in town come and work on the farm. I directed it for almost 10 years and loved doing it as a volunteer. And what I learned from Gaining Ground is the power of giving away something of quality for free, because the produce we grew wasn't just, you know, potatoes and onions and the stuff you sort of grow if you want to create heavy pumpkins, you know, things that weigh a lot. We grew, and still do, 200, 300 varieties of fruits and vegetables. So it's the sort of things that you would find in a Whole Foods, but that people that we were serving had never had access to. So it was astounding, and I enjoyed helping that group innovate and sort of get on its feet. And I took a lot of the lessons I learned from Gaining Ground, and clearly they'd been in the back of my head. And one night, you know, I woke up and I talked to my wife Anne. I said, you know, I think we should just publish Give and Take, the way we gave away vegetables at gaining ground. We'll print it up and we'll give it away. And we'll not just do that, but we'll ask people to give money to something they care about and or someone in need and then pass the book on. So it'll be one of these, the way people would normally deal with a paperback is you read it and you pass it on, but this takes advantage of it. And, you know, we created this whole notion called generosity-based publishing, built on, you know, the fact that that books have an intrinsic power beyond just the story. And readers, I think, are inherently very generous. So 4 years ago, we published the book, and on the back, it looks like a normal paperback, as you can see, but on the back it has a statement that some people call the Manifesto, that just says, "This novel is free. By taking a copy, you agree to give away money to a local charity, someone who needs it, or a stranger on the street. Where the money goes and how much you give, that's your call. When you're done, pass this novel on to someone else, for free, of course, so they can give. It adds up. Give and take is an experiment in publishing community, and now you're part of it." So this book we published, and if you see here the price, it's zero. So we published it, and we weren't really sure if it was going to work. You know, we thought we might get laughed at, or I might still be sitting on a box of these things. But it quickly got a tremendous amount of attention. We had requests from all over the world, and it raised between $60,000 and $70,000. Not for us. That was just all money that people gave away and told us about. And our website is just a long list of generosity. So we kept at it. We publish two or three books a year. We've always been in the black because everybody gives us their work for free. We did a book by Gregory Maguire, another Concord author who wrote Wicked. And it was a book that, you know, he was out of keeping with his normal work that's more sort of fantasy-oriented and set in Oz and what have you. This is a much more personal narrative and very funny. But each one, you know, sort of we built on each one. And we can get your story down to a bookmark, you know, you've got it down to nothing. And this is the sticker we used to put on. It's 100% off. That's the Barnes & Noble sticker with a couple extra digits. And we just were challenging. People said, you know, "You're trying to ruin publishing. What's your problem? You're like the Guy Fawkes of publishing, you know. You just want to set it on fire." And that wasn't it at all. What we really wanted to do is show that, you know what, 10 years ago we couldn't have done this. But now, because of technology and because of the internet and because of publishing technology and printing technology, you know, writers can start projects like this. I'm not a publisher. I'm a writer. Everybody on our staff is a writer or a designer. No one's a publisher. So the fact is that we were able to seize the machinery of publishing and do something brand new with it. Because all books, no matter what they're about, are the same. You know, you buy them. The publisher hopes to make a little bit of money on them so they can publish more books. And when you're done with your book, you probably give it away or sell it. This book and all the books that we do are, you know, like little messengers of generosity. I mean, they just travel through the world. And even the ones we published 4 years ago, every day we'll get a note from, they're each numbered too, so you can tell where they've been. You know, they're still making money out there, not for us, of course, but we're, you know, a little nonprofit that, as I say, is too small to fail. You know, we really don't. It's hard to imagine why we would quit. And anytime things get complicated or busy, we just say, you know what, let's just simplify it and do it another way. We're like relentless about keeping it, you know, easy to do because we're all volunteers. There are about 20 people, Russell Banks involved. Joyce Carol Oates, Megan Abbott, who else? Let me think. Scott Phillips. Hold on, don't come to me. Election. Tom Perrott. Help me. Tom wrote Election. Tom. Oh, it's in the back of this one. Kind of having a total brain freeze. We have a lot of people involved.
They'll probably come up in your discussions.
Tom Perrotta. There you go. And Francine Prose and just other writers who are interested in trying to do something new and to take advantage of the fact that in the old days, writers just waited for publishers to call, and now we can do a lot of different things. There's writers like Ann Patchett started her own bookstore in Nashville, writers who self-publish and run their whole little publishing empire themselves. We're doing something that I don't think anybody else is doing quite the same way, which is publishing great books and distributing them through independent bookstores and web requests and asking only that people be generous, which is, I think most people are generous to start with. We just have to ask them to do it.
Can you read us a selection out of Give and Take?
Wow, that's an idea.
Whoops.
Do I need to go?
No,
you don't.
You're the one.
Okay. So I'll read the first couple paragraphs from Give and Take, which came out with a free press edition in 2008, and then with St. Martin's, it went on to a second commercial life in the U.S. and abroad in 2010 and 2011. First chapter, Cleveland. I press my fingers on the warm keys of the grand piano and hear the thrum of huddled couples and clusters of bankers anxious to be entertained. My 10-foot Bösendorfer languishes in a NoHo loft, but I put aside that memory. It's just me and the slightly battered Baldwin tonight, two scarred nightclub veterans on a low stage, our world defined by a radiant ellipse from a flickering spotlight. The slow intro to Far Side of the Sun always works as an opener. Within a few bars, my fingers limber, the audience disappears, and my mind floods with whatever chemical wave the body releases when at complete peace with the world. I could say more about playing the piano, of course, but one man's bliss is another man's boredom. Tonight's set merges with the thousands played along club circuits from New York to San Francisco. My left hand marks progressions of solid chords, while my right traces the melody with only minor embellishment, a straight-ahead style, listenable and marketable. Through Malcolm, my agent, a new club in the flats has paid me $2,000 to play three 30-minute sets that will encourage people to buy more blue martinis, beer imported from Holland, and scallop appetizers on charred sugarcane skewers. I think of jazz the way a safecracker might, the right mix of familiar melodies and resonant chords sends tumblers clicking into place, opens long locked doors. My time at the keyboard relaxes and entertains the audience, causes subtle shifts in their emotional coloration that trigger spending, tips, positive word of mouth that might bring others in their appetites, wallets and credit cards to the Buckeye Club. When you carve the world down to its economic bones, you find money waiting in the marrow.
Wonderful. That's great.
That's his whole
MO. That's a page turner, isn't it?
Well, he's a good guy, the Ross, the piano player. He's got an unusual economic viewpoint, and you know, having a fast moving book that's basically ultimately about economics isn't something you would normally say, oh, I'm going to write a book that's got, you know, underlying issues of economic, you know, theory and or generosity and how to be, you know, sort of a fair person in the world. But that's why I like to sort of encode each book with other notes that, yeah, it may not be that obvious. You can still read it as just, here's a story about a piano player who steals stuff. But underneath it, there's a little bit more going on. And that's my job, to add that other stuff. And every book's different, you know? I mean, it's what I enjoy is taking on a new challenge. And my seventh book, which will be coming out next year, 2014, is a more flat-out crime novel called Third Rail. Takes place in Boston. I've lived here long enough that I can finally set a book in Boston proper. And it's much more, it's about a disgraced Boston policeman who has to sort of regain his honor. But it has elements of humor in it. And at one point, he's attacked by a Henry David Thoreau impersonator. And I figure, living in Concord, I know what an angry Henry David Thoreau impersonator might look like. So he's trying to hit him with a stick, you know. And so it's just this absurd moment. And again, would you, in a normal crime novel, have one of the bad guys be a Thoreau impersonator? Probably not. But I find it impossible to color within the lines of that genre. And my books are always somewhere between literary and thriller, but they always have a sense of humor, even the darkest ones. I'd like to think.
So what you've just shown me, the Give and Take, is the Concord Free Press?
Yeah, well, we published it. I figure when you're going to do something, you better use your own book as a guinea pig. And I did that book of my own first, and then everything published since then has been from other authors. My own work is published by, well, right now, by Houghton Mifflin. So, you know, I've got a separate career with mainstream publishing that's separate from my job as the Guy Fawkes of independent publishing. That's different. Luckily, I don't know, they work hand in hand. I learn something from publishing every time I embark on it. And I love to publish books. We love the process of editing and putting them together and making them look great. And if you're going to give away something for free, it has to be really, really good. Otherwise, people say, of course it's free. It's taff rotten, you know, like a bad apple. And that's our whole goal, is to make something that's so beautiful. When people get it, they can't believe they got it in the mail for free without even paying postage. And there's video online of just people who opened the book up and are holding it up and saying, I can't believe this happened. It changes the way they think about things. I hope just the money that we hear recorded on our site, $320,000 for 7 books, that's just part of it. That's the tip of the iceberg. I think what we've helped inspire people is like, wow, this is a company that's not a company, that's a project that mailed me a book in Tunisia. And I got it, and I didn't have to pay for it, and I gave money to something I care about, and I gave it to my friend, and he gave it to his friend. So it's just a very different way of... And we do mail books to Tunisia, very popular in Tunisia. We're also very popular among people who like to get free stuff from the internet, so it's sort of hard. You got to filter them out. That's a challenge. Because the world... there's always a downside to every project, and our books also get resold by unscrupulous book dealers for $200 and what have you. But neither here nor there. That's our Achilles heel, is we cannot police what happens to them. They're little acorns that can roll around and go wherever they want, you know. And I don't know, it's a project that, you know, I take great pride in, but it's really a group effort among a lot of people. And what I like most about it is everybody gives a little bit of time and energy and expertise, and the books come out, you know, it's almost not effortlessly, but without the same tumult that publishing a normal book requires. And they get attention, they get reviewed, and people love the idea of quote-unquote generosity-based publishing. And I think, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, I think that Concord, the place and the sort of ethos of the town, is very much centered on helping others and thinking unconventionally. And I think Thoreau would love the Concord Free Press. I think Emerson would like it too. I'm not sure about Hawthorne. Hawthorne was a little bit of a cipher. Louisa May Alcott, I don't know. She was sort of cranky. I'm not sure she'd like it either. She was cranky. But there's something in the water here that makes you want to do things differently. And it's very supportive of writers, but not just myself and Gregor Maguire and Alan Lightman and everybody else that's around here. But there's a lot of creative work being done here, and it's very rarely, you know, quote-unquote conventional. So I think there's a very supportive element here. Certainly the local bookstore and the library here really made the Concord Free Press happen. I mean, they let us do events and speeches and what have you. And, you know, you're not viewed as the usual oddball that most writers are when they do something unusual. You know, it's not a quirky, zany little project. They took it seriously. And it's much as it's fun, it's also an experiment that pushes the boundaries of publishing in a whole new direction.
So there's a community of writers here, would you say?
Oh, yeah.
Did I hear you say?
Yeah. I think so.
Of one another, any kind of a loose association where you drink coffee together once in a while?
It's not coffee we're drinking. It's a lot of wine involved. The good thing I like about it is it's not like the Concord Author Club is meeting on Friday. It's very ad hoc, and we all know each other pretty much, and some people are more inclined to socialize than others, but there's just a lot of sense that, oh, you know, we're very supportive of each other's work, and it's a small enough town that you know almost everybody anyway. The good thing about a small town is you never get lost. The bad thing is that everybody knows what you're up to. Okay, so on the bad side, people can tell because I write late at night. My neighbors will walk by and they'll say, "You were writing till like 2:14, maybe 2:15, and your head was down on the keyboard. Is that the way you write?" And it's like I was asleep. Anyway, because I can see my writing in my house, you know. So that's talking about writing as a public art, right? But you know, people, they support the books. People write here. The bookstore helps launch authors from here, and I'd say it's a very ad hoc thing. But the overall theme is that writers and readers are very supportive of their local citizen writers, and that's good because it's not like being in New York where everybody's trying to, you know, out-succeed everybody else.
Is there a local forum, a local lecture series? Does everybody kind of get a fair...
There is a Concord Festival of Authors every year that's run
start
by...
That again, please.
There's a Concord Festival of Authors run by Rob Mitchell and supported by the library and by the bookstore. And, yeah, it brings people, not just Concord authors, but other people here to town in the fall. And, you know, there's that event. I just read with a couple of poets at a event a church put together on shadow and light in creative work, and you know, we read outside in the most beautiful spring day ever, and I think the two people in the audience really enjoyed it, but and there were three of us on stage, so you just do it, you know, you go around and you read, you go to people's book clubs. I sit in people's living rooms and talk about it. They will read my book, and I have to talk about it. Which talk about, like sort of like the field work of fiction is when you're actually sitting there with readers at a very one-to-one level who've read your book, and they're not just invisible faces on the comments section of Amazon.com. They're asking you, you know, really tough questions. Why did you do this? Why did you do that? We thought this part sucks. It's like that's good to know. Not always easy to hear. But you know, I think there's a great sort of sense of directness and honesty here that is both good and bad. It can be sort of brutal and, you know, and be read as a little sharp around the edges sometimes, the way that Yankees can be. But generally, there's a directness here that lends people to say if they like what you're doing, they tell you they like it. If they don't like it, they'll tell you that too. Anyway, I think it's a good place to be a writer. It's also much easier to live a life here that's not just consumed by writing. You're forced to, you know, recognize that, oh, we're out in this beautiful little town. You can't just sit away in your Brooklyn, you know, attic and do nothing but bash the keys. It's important to get out every now and then. And I try to at least once every year or two go outside.
Well, you need to or not.
Yeah, I need to. I know. I like to get a little skin color. I don't want it to be paper colored like a book. Like a really new book.
So, going back to Princeton for a minute, when you first arrived at Princeton, you were wearing corduroys and
the cheap web belt.
Web belt.
Yep.
White corduroys.
Really white ones.
And paper white?
Yeah, that's a theme, isn't it? Yeah, they were definitely non-colored white people thing. Yeah, it was terrible. I probably still have them somewhere.
They're probably back in.
Yeah, well, if I keep them, I could sell them on eBay now, right? They'll be valuable. My daughters won't want them, I'm sure. But yes, back to your question. I was there as a naive young fellow.
From Arkansas.
Yeah, from many places, but
Cincinnati.
via a long family history of whatever rebellion, right? And
what was the response to? Did they extend, open their arms to welcome you in?
Well, that wasn't going to happen, but I didn't expect that. I'd spent the summer working in an oil field. I had sideburns down to my chin. I still had crude oil under every fingernail. I couldn't get rid of it. I was wearing a pair of boots that looked like they were made out of oil. They were so dirty. And this was, you know, when I cleaned up, I wore the white corduroys. But generally, I just looked like Johnny Paycheck or something. I looked like a complete hick. And I was driving just this terrible car, and a Chevelle that looked like it was always going downhill. It was like a race car thing, but it was really ugly. And then I traded it for a bright blue Ford Pinto that looked like just so ugly. It was just unbelievable. Anyway, so there, when everybody was very conscious about the aesthetics of how everything looked, I looked like the thing that didn't belong here. And some people pointed that out. People are generally, I think people when they're going to college, they're so lost in their own bubble of narcissism that they didn't bother to break through my bubble of narcissism. So we're just all there as free-floating, sort of like bubble wrap, you know, all there together in our bubbles, but not trying to pop each other. We left that to somebody else. And I felt welcomed by the institution in that it was had a great history, and I love history, and a sense that, you know, when you they'd throw you in your little Gothic dorm, which at that point was probably drafty and nasty. This is before they fixed everything up. And you'd find some student had carved his name in 1842, like with a diamond into one of the window panes. You know, you'd say, well, this place has been around here a long time. I should probably not break that window when I throw things. But I also felt it also fostered a very strong sense of rebellion, in that I didn't really go for the status quo. There were still all-male eating clubs there that were very fancy, very skull and bone sort of things, called Ivy Club and Cottage Club. And I shaved my head and went around sophomore year through the process by which you join these all-male eating clubs and wrote a scather about how they treated people that did this stuff. They got picked up by the New York Times and was one of the elements that helped bring those clubs down. So I felt that was one of my jobs. I wrote a story about a woman that had been sexually harassed by one of my own professors, and he was thrown out. So I was there as sort of a gadfly to the administration. I would say that I'm not communicated with very regularly by the trustees of Princeton University, and that's okay. I admire them for what they are, but during the time I was there, it was in transition from sort of old school to a much more diverse, much more open institution than it is today. And I'm one of the recruiters I only recruit students from Lowell, because I think people in Concord and, you know, the expensive towns and suburbs have all the resources they need, but I serve as their liaison to the city of Lowell. And I've met some of the most fascinating, most, you know, sort of ambitious and intellectual kids I've ever met out of Lowell. And I try to do what I can to answer their questions and point them toward Princeton, because they should go there. Let's check something. Yep.
Okay.
And I'm okay. I got a daughter appointment in a few minutes.
Okay. Well,
I can text you.
The other half of that question then is was there any of the same sort of dynamic when you arrived in Concord?
Yeah. We're
hearing that. Yeah. Sorry. This was off. I don't know why I did that. Hold on. Let me do this. This makes it even double secret off.
So the question was Concord waiting for you with open arms?
Well, that's a different question. Yeah. I know you'll turn off. Good. Concord was very welcoming. I mean, Concord, I wasn't from here, and a lot of people, you know, have lived here for generations. I didn't feel like an outsider. I felt very welcome. I felt like it was a friendly little town. I instantly love West Concord, where we live, a slightly different entity than Concord Center, but we just felt very much at home here right from the start. And yeah, we quickly found friends and places we loved here, and it was more welcoming. And in a way that it's sort of surprising in that it has such a long history, and a lot of people tend to live here for generations. So there are people whose families have been here for three and four generations or more. But there wasn't a lot of judgment about how new or old you were. I would say if I felt like we were frowned down upon as carpetbaggers. And at this point, we've been here 25 years, so it starts to add up. I think you have to be here for 25 generations before you get to get invited over to dinner. But I'm working on it. We're working on it. Over for a Patriot's pie or whatever they eat. I don't know. That's served at the Colonial Inn.
So give us a concluding remark. Go get your daughter.
Yeah. In conclusion, I think that my work as a writer is part and parcel in, my work as a citizen. I think you have to just be someone who's open to doing things in your community and helping out in any way you can. I think that writing is one way that you create something for the world, but there are a lot of other things you can create for the world. You can create a great startup company. You can come up with a brand new medical device or something. I think there's a lot of things that people create, and I think it's very easy as a writer to start to think, well, the only thing you can create is a book. And we live in an era now where the form and function of a book is being questioned and evolving, and I think that's really important because there's a lot more to a book than just the old style, sit down and read the book and then, put it away. I feel like the entity that is Concord is very welcoming of creative individuals who are coming up with ideas for, not just stories, but just different ways of doing work, different ways of living. We've banned individual water bottles here, making us both the laughingstock and the envy of lots of the U.S. because it seems like a small thing, but maybe it's really important. And if we're the first to do it, you got to remember, this is where we took the crazy act of shooting at the British, which no one else really thought would be a really good idea. But once we did it, it seemed to have caught hold, and they're not coming back. So it's a place full of a strong streak of individualism and rebellion, and I guess that maybe that's part of what I really feel when I live here. Great. Hope that helps. Thank you, sir.
Thank you both.